This statement appeared on the 1974 self-titled debut album from Kansas. From the beginning, we considered ourselves and our music different, and we hope we will always remain so. Little did the six-piece from Topeka, Kansas know, but the standards they set in the mid-70s were already ahead of their time. Steve Walsh on vocals, guitarist Kerry Livgren and Richard Williams, drummer Phil Ehart, bassist Dave Hope, and violinist Robbie Steinhardt went on to have 8 gold albums, 2 triple platinum albums, and a million-selling live record. And while they've undergone many lineup changes since then, including the departures of Kerry Livgren, Dave Hope, and Robbie Steinhardt, Kansas has continued touring and making music. In fact, they've just released an anthology of sorts called Works in Progress. It's a CD-DVD set and features the best of their studio and live recordings from 1992 to 2002. Now, this is your Uncle Joe Benson, and today, drummer Phil Ehart and guitarist Richard Williams and Kerry Livgren talk Kansas, past, present, and future, off the record. Talking with Phil Ehart and Rich Williams of the Kansas band. Phil, you are like the only guy who's been in every incarnation of the band since the beginning, aren't you?
Well, yes. There were a couple of different formations of Kansas before the one that signed the recording deal, yes.
When did you first hear about Rich? Were you familiar with him playing someplace before he joined the band?
Well, Richard was a really popular male stripper in Topeka.
You know, the nickname for Rich.
Well, yeah, we'll just leave it at that. But
it started with Long and
went from there. Mm-hmm. But no, actually, Rich and I played in our very first band together, the Pets.
First year of high school. So me and Phil have been playing together since 1965 or 6.
Wow. And Richard, I remember, came over in a basement of another band I was playing in, and Richard owned a Fender Jaguar guitar. And I thought, man, what great equipment.
This guy's got the ring.
Yeah, he does. And we'll just leave it at that. But, yeah, Richard and I played in the first band together. So when it came time to kind of put this together, I knew that it was Rich was the guy. I mean, as it turned out, he made me look good.
Growing up, you know, in the middle of the Midwest there, we really got a little bit of everything. You'd have Johnny Cash followed by the Rolling Stones, followed by something from Motown, followed by the Hog Report.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just that was normal AM radio. It was little bits and everything. So we really got what a balance of influences.
And Phil, you started Kansas. Had your influences switched more to, say, someone like Yes or something of that nature, something more complex?
Yeah, I mean, the whole British thing. I mean, I remember being over in England for a while before I came back and started Kansas, you know, getting the first King Crimson record and never hearing of a band, you know, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and bringing those records back. But that kind of music was always kind of beyond us. I think it's music that we respected and that we liked. But I don't think, you know, Kansas ever, you know, aspired to be like Yes or aspired to be like EOP. It was the kind of thing that we were more of an Allman Brothers Deep Purple type of, you know, Kansas is always much more guitar driven. And I think obviously an ELP and a Yes really wasn't, you know, even though Steve Howe's a great guitar player, he's not a rock guitarist, you know. So I think Jimmy Page and Richie Blackmore and those kind of guys, and even, you know, like Terry Kath out of Chicago, you know, somebody that really influenced Kerry Livgren. He loved Terry Kath because he was a blues player, you know. And here's this horn band with this ripping guitar player that was just great. And you know, Carlos Santana and people like that. There was a lot of guys on the American side, too, that influenced this band. There was, like Rich said earlier, there's just so many influences. But I think lots of times because of the arrangements of our songs and the different time signatures. But, you know, you listen to the Allman Brothers, they had a lot of very complicated time signatures going on also. So I think it's always easy for people to go, well, they're trying to sound like Yes or they're trying to sound like Genesis. And we never really were. I mean, like I said, we had 2 guitars in the band and we rocked a lot harder.
You know, what's funny is we couldn't sound like anybody else if we tried. When we were a copy band, we were terrible at it. Now, everything we tried to do wound up sounding like us, and I guess that it was frustrating at first, but we didn't know that we were really fine-tuning what we were. And even some of our material, there's stuff that we've done in the studio that we couldn't copy ourselves live. It just didn't sound right. It was just never a successful thing for us to try to do as a part of a live show. Some things worked, some things didn't. We're just not a good copy band.
Out of the ashes of the first one, well, we split into two groups. I went with Kansas, and Phil and Dave and Rich came into it, and they started White Clover. And that was when Steve came into the picture. He actually joined White Clover, and I was still in Kansas. And we were kind of rival bands. There came a day when Phil came to me and said, you know, we got great players, but you've got great songs. Why don't we get together and make one better band out of all this? And, of course, it was hard for me to leave the guys I'd been playing with, who put a lot of work into that second Kansas band. But looking back on it, I made the right move. And that's how the recording Kansas that everybody's familiar with came to be.
My favorite things about you guys, from the early days on, I think A Song for America was the first album I became aware of, and some of the work that was in there. At that point, though, Phil, you were the only... There may have been two guitars. There may have been keyboards. There may have been a violin, but you were the only drummer, and still you were handling almost as much as the two guys in the Allman Brothers were doing. You've always been a technical drummer, one of the foremost technical drummers around. That had to be driving the rest of the band as well to raise their level. Or did you just see, if this is what I'm doing? It wasn't like keep up with me.
Well, and I appreciate those comments, but no, the guys were never struggling to keep up with me. They were more than competent to play anything they wanted to, but I've never made any bones over the fact that Kansas is an absolutely incredible band for a drummer to play in. I mean, you never, ever, ever get bored in this band playing drums, and I think because of the music, you know, people have recognized me as a drummer, and I always appreciate that, but I've always given the accolades to the music that was written, made me look awfully good, and so it's, you know, always been a pleasure to be a part of this band musically, because it's so demanding in the drummer's chair. I mean, it's, and Kerry and Steve, most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time would just say, just play whatever you want. And if they didn't like what I played, they'd usually make a comment, you know, change this or change that. But, yeah, it's always been very, very demanding. And have never taken any lessons. I was self-taught, so I didn't really have any schooling to draw upon. And that's probably what helped me develop my own style, was that Kerry and Steve were writing this music. And it's not like I'm going to reach back and go, what would Tony Williams have done? You know? I didn't know who Tony Williams was, you know. So it was the kind of thing that I was probably just dumb enough when it came to playing drums that I just was able to come up with my own stuff. And the input from the other guys always had comments for me to try too. So it's never boring, never been boring ever.
One of the things I've enjoyed about Kansas over their career, the first part of the career, Jeff Glucksman, who was your producer, was also your sound man, and he actually wasn't he in a rival band with you when you started out?
Well, I was in a band with Jeff.
And so was I. We both played in different bands with him. So he was, you know, a band guy, and he lived there in Topeka, but he was very good at engineering. And so I remember making the phone call that we were heading out on the road, and I called him and I said, Jeff, why don't you come with us? And he said, man, I'd love to. So he came out and started as our sound man. And by the second album, he was sitting behind the console recording us and got a production credit. Then he produced Mass, also Left Overture, as well as Point of No Return.
So it was like having family behind the board as well.
Very much so, yeah.
Kerry Livgren to join the band Kansas. Drummer Phil Ehart.
I think a lot of people that, again, don't realize that, you know, four of us pretty much grew up together through high school and early college. And so, you know, Kerry was just one of the guys. You know, Kerry, his favorite color was, you know, like lime green. And, you know, he was kind of a dork. And he, you know, if he was here on this interview, he'd agree and he'd actually be proud of it.
He'd probably still be wearing a dickie.
Yeah, and, you know, he wore dickies and lime green shirts, and probably a lot of people were going, dickie, what the heck's that? But, you know, it's... And then Kerry got into this mode. You know, he was just kind of always this nerd guy. And then all of a sudden, he started writing songs like Song for America and The Wall and Kerry on Wayward Son. He was kind of going, who is this guy? You know, where did this guy come from?
It just,
you know,
poured out of him.
I mean, it was like, we just got out of the way. I mean, Steve will tell you, too. I mean, Steve was, you know, submitting songs at that time. And this period of time for about a... Oh, probably about a 10-year time period between probably starting at Song for America, going through probably Monolith, was just a prolific time for him that he would tell you he's never been able to replicate. And it's something where we just got out of the way. It was just every day, it was like, what's Carrie bringing the day? And 99 times out of 100, it was just freaking awesome. And it was just this goony guy, you know? It was kind of like the Nutty Professor. It wasn't anything that we had experienced before or he had experienced before. So it was a magical time for all of us, but it was really amazing because Carrie, and then Steve would jump in and help Carrie with the melodies and some of the lyrics, and we were all involved in the arrangements. So it was really about a 10-year time period, about a decade there, when it was really truly a band. I mean, where the band was very much involved.
And he was my favorite writer of all time, in that period. I mean, it's just, if it was maybe just all growing up together or something, but it seemed like what we wanted to do, he'd show up with that next piece of the puzzle. And it was, and I was a fan of his writing really before this Kansas started, but boy, he hit a stride.
Joe Benson talked with Phil Ehart and Richard Williams of Kansas here on Off the Record. About the time you'd released three albums, the first one self-titled, Song for America and Mask, and you had not made a large commercial impact at this point in time when Left Overture came out. Before that tour started, you did your warm-up gig at in Beloit, Wisconsin. It was a very cold night in a small room. Did you feel pressure on yourselves that you had to accomplish something as far as we have to get some hits? What was going through your mind before Left Overture came out and hit so big?
Well, I'll tell you what, Don Kirshner sure wouldn't let us forget, as far as some sort of obligation to a hit song, because Don Kirshner was all about, hit records, with the Monkees and with the Archies and Neil Sedaka and Carole King and, everybody that he had signed publishing-wise. Well, it was no different with us. And even though we were making steady inroads with our sales from album to album, he wanted that hit song. That's what he wanted. And he started, making no bones about it as, guys, this is great. I know you're having a good time, but we need a hit song. We need to get it on the radio. So when we went in to do Left Overture in Topeka, and we worked it up before we took it down to a studio in the country, the album had been worked up and arranged. We were ready to go, and Carrie came in the last day of rehearsals and set up, got a song that I think we should put on the record called Carry On Wayward Son. Well, we didn't even work it up. We didn't even work it up in rehearsals. We took it with us to the studio and worked it up in the studio. And that's one of those, moments in time you remember, because we started working it up and nobody really went, hey, that's a song, that's a hit song. But Jeff Glicksman, our producer, was the first one to kind of start turning to everybody at the console and going, this sounds like a hit song. This sounds like something that'd be on the radio. So that was really our first accidental attempt. We had had some other attempts to write a quote-unquote hit song that just didn't work out earlier. And we put Left Overture out, and then a number of months later, our manager walked in to the dressing room at one of our
incredible dry spell. He didn't have anything. And so when I got to the rehearsal for Left Overture, the guy said, you got to write all the songs. And so I came with two or three, but we would learn a song all day long, and then I would go home and have to write one that night to learn the next day. And then we'd learn that one. And then I'd go home that night and write another one to learn the next day. And that's really no way to do it. Although, in retrospect, it was some of the most productive periods I went through. I'm in a position where either we were going to fade away into obscurity or go on upward. And thankfully, the advent of Carry On Wayward Son changed everything overnight for us. And that, as has happened so many times with Kansas, that song was an afterthought. We had actually worked out all the songs for Left Overture. It was not there. It was not among them. And we had gone down to the studio outside of New Orleans where we recorded. We used to like to work down there. And we were already in the studio. And I wrote Wayward Son kind of just before we left and finished it on the way down there. And we got down there and I said, guys, you really ought to listen to this. I know this is no time to be learning something new, but they listened to it, just kind of looked at me and said, let's go do it. And we actually learned it in the studio, put it together down there.
There's no internet to keep track of how ticket sales are doing. There was no sound scan to see how many copies were being sold minute by minute. It was all quite medieval, actually, the way they kept track of those kind of things. What was the first indication you had that Kansas as a band was becoming much more popular, and it wasn't, was it just because the gigs started getting bigger, or did Mr. Kirshner actually keep you informed how sales were going constantly?
Well, yeah, we had been an opening band for three albums.
Mm-hmm.
We'd opened up for hundreds of different bands, and all of a sudden, your first indication is you're asked to headline. Because, you know, we were traveling so much, we weren't really listening to the radio. And then, you know, all of a sudden you notice that, wow, we're headlining this place where we opened for Queen last year. We're now headlining. And now all of a sudden, we don't have one headlining date. We have 30 headlining dates. And all of a sudden, we're not just headlining, we're selling out. And then all of a sudden, we go from theaters to auditoriums. And then the next thing you know, we're playing stadium in Kansas City, you know, with Van Halen opening for us, you know. So it's the kind of thing that... it happens rather quickly. When you have a hit, it's get out of the way, basically.
It's funny how the Billboard magazine, you just don't care about Billboard until you're on it. And boy, does it become important all of a sudden. Everybody's in the back of a limo reading the next copy. And it's either good news or bad. Then when you slide off, you don't care about that magazine anymore. I definitely remember all of a sudden Billboard was really important to us.
And Cashbox.
Cashbox, yeah.
And Record World, all three of those kinds of things.
Road for nearly a year in support of their first million-selling album, Left Overture. And then they took some much-needed time off. They returned home to the rehearsal space in Topeka to begin work on a follow-up album, but the intense pressure to create another, more successful album only resulted in added tension between the band members. This is your Uncle Joe Benson, and coming up, drummer Phil Ehart and guitarist Rich Williams remember singer Steve Walsh's brief departure from Kansas. Plus, we'll hear the Carrie Livgren guitar warm-up exercise that turned... Phil Ehart and Richard Williams here off the record. This is your Uncle Joe Benson with you. It was quite a transition. Left Overture made you stars. You had yourself a hit single, but you also were packing bigger halls, as we talked about how you went to headlining status. When you went into the studio for Point of No Return, had things changed within the band? Was everybody still the same? Or was it just this pressure to follow up? What was going on?
Well, you would think that, you know, coming out of a little tiny town like Topeka, and all of a sudden you're playing big stages in the United States, and what's going on, that the prospect of a new album would be something that would be very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Unbeknownst to us, Steve decided to quit at that time, you know, in the middle of Point of No Return. And because we'd already worked up the material, and we really had a great record. We knew that Point was going to be good. We knew we had Point of No Return as probably a lead single, followed by Dust in the Wind. So a plan actually started to materialize, and we were starting to get pretty good at what we were trying to do. And then Steve decided to leave the band, and I remember he was going to go in and sing Dust in the Wind, even though he was quitting. I remember sitting there, and I think it was in Nashville when he was singing Dust in the Wind, that thinking, God, this is going to be such a drag. Or I got to find somebody to replace Steve, you know. But so to answer your question, yes, things were changing, starting there with Steve. And, you know, he wanted to go off and do his own thing. And we were able to convince him to stick around. And he did. And it worked out for the best. But, yes, then once we got back on the road, then things got back to quote-unquote normal, which was out doing lots and lots of dates. And Point of No Return, once it was released as a single, did top 20, and then Dust came along and just blew the roof. So we had Carry On Wayward Son, followed by Point of No Return, right into Dust in the Wind. So we were just selling out everywhere. We were breaking ticket sales records in buildings that had ticket sales records held by Elvis and stuff like that. So for, you know, a bunch of high school guys from Topeka, we were doing, you know, way beyond anything we ever thought we could do.
When Carrie came up with a song, Dust in the Wind, he has said it was basically a finger exercise, a warm-up exercise.
Mm-hmm.
When he brought the song in, is that what you thought as well, or did you say, my God, this is something?
We were playing in Des Moines, Iowa, just before we even got our record deal, and we were, on Saturdays was a jam session. We, of course, we had to be the backup band, whoever wanted to jam.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one guitar player that always come in. He was a very good player. And just, you know, sitting around and stuff, we'd never really messed with acoustic guitars at all. And he was a fairly accomplished picker, and he showed us this certain picking style. And we never really did anything with it. And a few years later, Carrie thought he wanted to remember that, so he thought he'd just write a little pattern to kind of practice that around. And that evolved into the chord pattern for Dust.
Oh, my God.
And then he...
Wait a minute, are you saying that he plagiarized that?
Well, yeah, that's simple Travis pick, so...
Oh, okay, no big deal. Okay, never mind.
But, you know, we'd never done it before. Mm-hmm. And so then he read something that kind of inspired him, and he wrote the lyrics, and I'll never forget, he brought in a little recording of the acoustic, and he was kind of singing this falsetto to Steve, reading the lyrics, and me and Phil looked at each other, boy, there's definitely something here, and Kerry couldn't see it.
He told us, he said, you guys probably aren't going to be interested in this song because it's an acoustic song. I said, well, yeah, let's hear it. We were interested.
Yeah, it was just unlike anything we'd ever done before, but... We heard it right away.
Mm-hmm.
Even with Kerry singing it, he's a little better than I am, and that's not saying anything.
The majority of the time, there was a distinct meaning to the things I was writing. It may have been very personal and difficult to express in any other terms except through a song. I did then, and I still do, draw very heavily from things that I read. There's just several universes of great ideas out there to draw from. The other thing was a lot of my lyrics are chronicles of sort of a personal spiritual journey that I was on. You'll notice that Kansas songs are not boy-girl songs, and they're not about some of the more common subjects that things were about back then, but they tend to be more, you know, pretty deep waters as a rule.
Walsh left Kansas in November of 1980, and Kerry Livgren quit after a final New Year's Eve performance in 1983. Then, in 1986, Steve Walsh rejoined the band and has been recording and touring with them ever since. Kerry Livgren made a temporary return to the lineup in 1990, only to leave again after the band's 1991 tour. He temporarily reconvened with his bandmates again in 2000 when Kansas recorded the Somewhere to Elsewhere album, the first new studio record to feature the famous Six in some 20 years. This is your Uncle Joe Benson. In the 2006 Kansas incarnation, featuring singer Steve Walsh, guitarist Rich Williams, and drummer Phil Ehart, has undergone yet another change. We'll find out who's in and who's out for the summer tour. Plus, guitarist Richard Williams and drummer Phil Ehart give us an inside look at the latest Kansas offering, the live CD-DVD set Works in Progress. Off the Record. We'll be right back. Listen with you here. Speaking off the record with Phil Ehart and Richard Williams of Kansas. Your live show is so dynamic. There's so much going on, not only with guitars and keyboards and performing and all that, but you have one of the most dynamic drummers there is in the business, and it's my contention that drummers hold everything together that way, visually as well as keeping the beat going. It's really neat to see the videos of your various performances, and you've compiled a number of them on the new release called Works in Progress. How did you decide what to put in this, and were you surprised when you went back and looked at how well you were playing in some of these things?
It's the kind of thing that every once in a while you get a call from a label that owns a number of your recordings. And they'll call and say, we have Live at the Whiskey, we have Freaks of Nature, we have Always Never the Same, and we have Device Voice Drum. Four different recordings that you've been on the label in the last 10 years, we'd like to do a compilation. And contractually, they can do the compilation without us, or they can do the compilation with us. So we decided that we would look at from a band's point of view to look over the material and put the material selection together. Then Jeff Glicksman and myself went to work in doing the remastering, doing the artwork as well as the liner notes, and trying to pick things and do things that would make it halfway interesting for the Kansas fan who may have already owned those particular recordings, or make it interesting for someone who's never owned any of those recordings. When they pick this up as a standalone piece, it stands on its own. And so we worked really hard in making that happen. And yeah, we're very happy with the way it turned out.
Phil Ehart and Richard Williams. Kansas works how many months out of the year? You're on the road, it seems like quite a bit, but you do take time off to actually live and breathe. So you're doing, is it a summer tour? Is that what this is?
No, we tour year-round. You know, sometimes we'll be out there for 3 weeks. Sometimes we'll be out there for a day. Sometimes it'll be, you know, just on and off. But we're always available. We're not chronically available, but we'll work in January. We'll work in August. I mean, if something comes up, we have a chance to play, we'll go play.
The spring through early fall is when we're busiest. And the Christmas holidays, we're always off. But Other than that, we work all the time. It's just we do it at our own pace. We don't do 40 shows a week. We generally, for most of it, do 2-3 shows a week at the most. And then go home. See, we get a balance of home life and the road. And that assures for a happy bunch of guys most of the time.
You've just altered the lineup again. You've gone to another shift in lineup. Do you want to go into that a little bit?
No.
Okay.
That's great. Yeah, Robbie Steinhardt, our original violinist, departed the band in the last month or so, and we came kind of to a decision between himself and the band that it was just time for him to retire, and he did. And we supported him in that retirement. And we brought David Ragsdale back, who was with us back in the early 90s, and as our violinist. And we're up and going and sounding great and enjoying playing on the road.
It's funny how all these things just work out. 2 months ago, this album was coming out, but we hadn't, the switching the violinist was not even a subject. And it's changed. You usually think it's something that's going to be abrupt and very painful. Mm-hmm. It was sad to see Robbie go, but on the other hand, happy to have David back. Mm-hmm. And it's been as flawless and easy of a changeover as I've ever seen within this organization, really, any. We're all very happy to have David in the band, so it's onward and upward for us.
Been any new Kansas music in the next year or so?
No.
There's nothing chiseled in stone planned. No. There's a lot of balls to juggle. That didn't sound right either.
Let me go back here.
That seems to be your specialty, though.
Right? Yeah. Ball juggling all day.
And just keeping everything afloat, the music has to come from somewhere, and that doesn't exist at the moment. And the time doesn't exist. So, if there was a bunch of great material to do, there's a will for us to do it. It's just, all those things have to come into play first. And, hopefully that will happen.